Well, I'd like to start by thanking Emma and Joe for inviting me to present today. And the title of my talk is Your Eyes Are My Hands. And it's a line from the first page of the artist book that I've just had published. And the book is basically, I'm going to do the talk in two parts. It's going to be a bit of a whistle-stop tour. I'm going to talk about the exhibition that's just opened at the Museum Haus Konstruktiv in Zurich, which is part of the a kind of centenary celebration of Dada in the city of its birth. And the title of my show at the exhibition is... you have to be quiet when I say this. It's... And it's obviously my initials, but it relates to my ideas about machinery and a machine aesthetic. It's also a sound, a kind of little sound poem in homage to one of the women who I've been very interested in terms of the whole project itself at the Museum Haus Konstruktiv. So the book, which is literally just hot off the press, is this one. It's called Omni Pulse Pun Slide. And it's not a catalogue for the exhibition, it's an artist's book, but it relates very specifically to what's in the exhibition and also to the whole concept of Dada Anders at Museum Haus Konstruktiv, which translates, for those who don't speak German, as Dada differently. So the curatorial premise of the show at the Museum Haus Konstruktiv was to look at the way that women were involved in the Dada movement. And I was very interested in this when I was offered the opportunity to take part and to do a solo show in the museum. I thought this is fantastic because one of my concerns has been a kind of to explore the kind of hidden protagonists within the early modernist movement. So I looked at people like Eileen Gray, Charlotte Perriand, Lily Reich, all of whom were sort of defined by their relationship by their more famous male partners or colleagues. And I'd also been making some work about women in surrealism. I found this to be a very... For me, surrealism is a very trap-laden space for women artists, partly because of the way in which women's bodies are objectified and the way that their physical selves are kind of fragmented and dislocated and the way that they become objectified. So I was looking at, in particular, three women artists who were showcased on the top floor of the museum. And two of them are very well known, Hannah Hook and Sophie Tabarp. And another woman called Elsa, I'll give her full title. She's called Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven. And she's not actually aristocracy. She, certainly not by birth. She was a shop girl from Munich who married a baron. But more of that later. One of the things that's obviously been revealed by the exhibition at the museum in Zurich is just how important women were to the Dada movement. And I suppose one normally associates surrealism with the beginning of a kind of more inclusive form of modernist art movement where women are actively making and contributing and taking part in a kind of an artistic movement or scene. But what I thought was really interesting about the women in Dada was that they were not muses. They were not the beautiful objects. They were not these uncanny objects of desire. They were very much kind of agents and very much their own subjects rather than objects. And I think their contribution to Dada is very much defined by what they made, how they performed, and what they said. So they were very verbal, very present, but they weren't these ethereal, undefinable creatures. And with the exception of Sophie Tabarp, I think they were not so defined by their relationship with their male colleagues, that they had a kind of independence, which for me was very exciting to see. So I'm going to show you... let's see if I can operate this. Yeah, so it's called Dada Anders, and the exhibition itself was in a museum that was an ex-electricity-generating industrial building. Very beautiful, actually, and very sort of modernist in its aesthetic. So for me, it was this perfect setting. And that's the poster for the show. And so again, is obviously my initials repeated. And it's a homage to a kind of Dada sound poetry that was, perpetrated particularly by Baroness Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven. And it was a kind of embodied sonic poetry that was performed as well as written, as well as drawn. And I liked the kind of interdisciplinary nature of this, and also the way that her poetry explores this sort of the interstices, or the kind of strange, porous space between sensory perception and meaning acquisition. And so for me, it was an extremely interesting way to think about the relationship between looking and making, between being seen and performing. So this is, I'm going to show you a couple of the works that are in the show, then some installation shots of the exhibition, and try and race through this to get through it all. So this is a series of works that were made in 2013 under the title of As Given. And what you're looking at is a kind of, it's a photographic collage, but a collage done in real space and real time. So the object itself is a photograph of a sculpture made by Marcel Duchamp. And it's called... it'll come to me in a minute. Sorry. it's a wedge of chastity. That's it. And this object and a number of other objects were made by casting the negative spaces underneath and between the legs of the figure in Eton Donné, which I'm sure you all know. It's a peep show where you look through a little hole in a big box, and then you see this headless woman lying, legs splayed, as if she has been violated or who knows what, in a landscape holding a lamp. And it's a kind of, it's one of the kind of key pieces of 20th century art, along with the fountain, but more of that later. So I was interested in what it means to sort of think about these negative spaces becoming objects, and also that they have a strongly erotic aspect. This is a female fig leaf, and this is objet d'art. So, I mean, they're clearly very charged erotically. And I think one of the reasons I was attracted to doing the talk here at the Freud Museum today is that I'm interested in the way that Freud thinks about sexuality and desire, and how he says that sexuality cannot be extracted from our subjectivity. It constitutes us and who we are. And obviously whether you're male or female are going to give you a different history in relation to that particular form of constitution. So I'm obviously very aware of the way in which these are kind of clear references to kind of body parts and female body parts, male body parts, but it's quite ambiguous. And particularly this one, which is actually the space underneath the breast of the woman in Eton Donné, but it comes out as a kind of clearly phallic shape. And what I'm doing in all three of these photographs, and in some of the others that I'm going to show you, is I'm touching a flat photograph. So this is not an object, because the real object is, like some of them, I could hold them in, you know, in one hand, maybe. They're tiny, especially the one, the female fig leaf, because it's the space between the figure's legs. So I've enlarged them, I printed them as black and white photographs, and I smeared my hands with black and white makeup, and then meticulously painted black and white and grey and silver nail varnish on my fingernails, so that my hands become part of the archive. So they, although I'm touching a photograph, it looks like I'm touching the thing, the object itself. So the photographic register unites real object and photograph and makes the archival more alive. It sort of animates this archival object. But also I become, in a sense, part of this archival history, and it's a weird process of transference in which it's as if, as I'm touching the black and white photograph, the black and white documentary nature of it kind of runs up my arm, and I become part of this sort of archival past. And in a lot of my work, I restage and reinterpret archival photographs. And if we get time, I'll show you a couple of the ones that I've done that are more clearly related to actual documentary photographs themselves, where I kind of restage the whole thing. A little bit of biography. I trained as a painter, and I see these very much as a kind of part of a painting practice, because what I'm doing is that a lot of it is to do with chance and performing with materials, and there's a kind of unpredictability in the way that some of the photographs turn out, because I never work with a studio assistant, partly to do with finance. I'm always available, so I can be my own model. I don't have to pay myself. And I also very much, I like the accidental things that happen and the endless takes and retakes that you can do when you work with yourself. So it really is about kind of being embodied and intimately inhabiting this archival space in a way that if I had somebody behind the camera framing everything up and saying, ah, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, it would become their photograph. So it's really important I work blind. So the camera's here and I'm doing my stuff and it's all timer and shutter release. And I like the timer the most because it gives it a kind of edgy, kind of even more of a performative element. So just to sort of, yeah, quick run back. So these are kind of, these are ways of literally inhabiting a kind of archive that normally we encounter archives behind glass or in books, and there's this sense of a kind of historical as well as literal distance. You're not allowed to touch these things. So for me, there's a kind of thrilling invasion of this pristine, sterile, distant space of the archive itself. Like I sort of want to be inside it and to know how it feels. And obviously this is entirely an imaginative fantasy. But this is the Freud Museum after all. So, so this is, just another example of, this wasn't in the show, but it's a colour photograph and obviously there's no makeup on the hand. But one of the things that you probably noticed in the photographs themselves is that the lighting and the shadows corresponds. And this is really for me why it works, because there's a sense in which the directional lighting and the texture and the surface has to knit, otherwise it just looks too much like something is superimposed. So the real shadows and the real lighting and the general chromatics have to just about match. But I like it kind of when they don't. And when you get, I don't know if you can see it, but there's a kind of pinkish zone. Because I can't, yeah, underneath the thumb, where because I do repeated takes, that sometimes usually the makeup wears off, and sometimes it smears on the photograph. So, but it's the type of dirt that I like. Because dirt is good. Dirt is matter out of place. This is one of the pieces that was also in the exhibition, and it's called Rosebush Wheels. And the title relates to a poem by Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven, and also to a certain performance conducted by a woman called Sheila Legge in the 1936 Surrealist exhibition in Trafalgar Square, where she stood in Trafalgar Square and posed with various objects with a rose bush entirely covering her head. So she was effectively anonymous. So she becomes the ultimate surrealist muse, you know, sort of sphinx-like, enigmatic, beautiful, elegant, but you can't see her. You've got no idea who she is. So this has become a kind of, not a device as such, but something I like in my recent series of photographs. So I try and bring it into a lot of the photographs that I work in, because some of the work that I've made over the last 2 years has kind of migrated into other projects and for a forthcoming show in Brussels. So there's a kind of, it was a fairly open and flexible approach to the theme of the exhibition Dada Anders as a whole. But what, in true Dada style, some really interesting things happened, that some of the work, I mean, I was pretty much working blind until the curator told me exactly which works were going to be included in the exhibition in Zurich. And then when I saw some of what they'd chosen, it was kind of meant to be. It was more than chance. There was a sense in which some of the things were clearly relating to what I'd chosen to work with. So the checkerboard floor is actually a reconstruction of a Sophie Thaba Arp collage called Duo Collage. It's not one of her most famous works. And to my utter amazement, when I turned up on 2 weeks ago to hang the show, it was in the exhibition. And it was just like I mean, for me, I guess it's more interesting for me to know that than you. But there's a sort of, there was a really, it was a really thrilling experience doing this show, because some of the objects and the artifacts that they had got were very rare and very fragile. And it was really exciting for me to be literally surrounded by this archival material. So this piece also relates back to a series of works that I did around the work, the performances and the persona of Josephine Baker. And maybe I'll just give you a few clues as to what you're looking at, because you're probably thinking, what the hell is this? It's me, and I'm smeared in grey makeup, but not entirely, because I wanted to reveal something of the manufacture of the image itself. I'm holding a champagne glass, and in the champagne glass is a photograph of a sculpture by Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven called Portrait of Marcel Duchamp. And it was something, it doesn't exist anymore. It was a very fragile, ephemeral sculpture that had chicken bones and feathers and jewelry, and was just kind of knocked together. And so it no longer exists except as a photograph. And of course, the photograph is what I used to cut it out and shove the whole thing in a champagne glass. And it looks like the real thing, because the photographic register unites. My outfit is, if you can call it that, is blown up photographs of the molds that were used for the actual body of Letton Donnet. So I'm literally wearing fragments of Duchamp's sculpture and trying to line up the bits. So the tits match my tits, belly button and crotch all pretty much align. So hence some of the contortion of the figure. And also the black and white nature of the photograph and of the rosebush. There's a kind of mismatching and unregistering and fragmenting of this black and white register, which kind of falls apart and comes together. And that unstable image is really something that I'm excited by. And I've always liked that sense in which the image just seems to be sort of shifting. Is it now? Is it then? Or is it the past? Is it black and white? Is it colour? So this is another two pieces that were in the show. So I'll show you this one first. It's called She's Not, and it relates again to a Duchamp sculpture, which is called Not a Shoe. And it's the cast from underneath the arm of Etton Donnet, and it creates a shoe shape. It's a sort of, it's part breast, part armpit, essentially. And when he cast this space as a positive bronze sculpture, it looks like a boot or a shoe. So what I did was I printed it, cut it out, blew it up, stuck it on a piece of cardboard, cut a hole in the cardboard, smeared my leg in black and white makeup, a grey sort of stage makeup, and put the shoe on. There's something, again, the photographic register unites this material, so it's kind of convincing, but there's something not quite right about it. And then this is a kind of colour version of the same idea, where the shoe's a bit bigger, actually. So both these pieces were in the show, and there was I felt that I was very much responding to a kind of Duchampian legacy of Dada. And I was interested very much in this idea of the surrealist object, which, I suppose what Dada really means to me in a way was that I think it, as well as being humorous and nihilistic, it was also a very heartfelt attempt to try and articulate the experience of the urban metropolis, of new ideas about the self, about the body, response to the First World War, ideas about sexuality, about gender, that kind of weren't sayable in other forms. So part of the formal inventiveness of Dada is not just provocation, it's a kind of desperation, in my opinion, that, you know, this, they needed to be a new way to say new things. So some of the language is borrowed from constructivism, and hence the close relationship between constructivism and Dada. And some of the languages were sort of preempts modes of surrealism. So I think, I mean, for me, Dada is not a coherent movement by any stretch of the imagination. So this is some slightly I'm not very good at photographing installations, so you have to bear with me. But this was done on the last day of the hang, and I literally came back from there a couple of days ago. So the official institutional photographs have yet to be forwarded to me. So these are my amateur versions. My apologies in advance for that. So the hang is quite Dada. The leg photograph you can see in the corner kicks off the rest of the installation. So it's quite, in that sense, it's a kind of unconventional-ish hang. And I'll be showing some of the other photographs shortly. But I just thought I should give you a little idea of the kind of layout of the show itself and what was in it. So yeah, we're back to the beginning. Okay, two other pieces that were also in the show were another rosebush wheel photograph. Again, a similar process. So this is the negative of that. Mm-hmm. And I've become obsessed, I think, about the nature and the relationship between the positive and the negative, between the inverted and the non-inverted. And there's a... it's partly to do with the language of photography and what photography allows you to say, but also about something that the idea of the photographic negative says about time and about the present. On a very simple level, I think the photographic negative creates the uncanny. It creates a kind of strange distance between the positive and its negative sister or brother or whatever you want to call it. That it's never, if you see a picture of yourself and then you see the negative, it's not the same thing. It's a kind, and so something happens in this relationship between the positive and the negative. And there's a kind of an estrangement that I really like. So again, I'm kind of struggling to fit myself into this étendonné outfit. There's also a reference, and there's another version of the sculpture that I'm holding in my hand. And in étendonné, the female figure is holding a lamp in almost the same manner that I'm holding the champagne glass with the Elsa von Freytag, Loring Hoven portrait of Marcel Duchamp. So I'm turning, in a way, I suppose, Marcel Duchamp into my kind of object, my thing that I can come play with. And going back to what Griselda said earlier about maybe art can be a kind of a way of critically re-examining certain orthodoxies, that it plays an active and inquisitive and perhaps rebellious role in this. And, the female body is a kind of... this. One of the problems I've always had with using my own physical form in the work is a kind of, not so much vanity or reserve or... embarrassment, but a sense in which I'm thoroughly aware of the way in which the image of the female body, the representation of the female form, is so easily co-opted into the opposite of what you're trying to say quite often. But I think that, you know, post people like certainly Jemima Stelly, Hannah Wilkie, there's a whole sense in which I'm not saying the language has been fully cleansed, but there's now a different relationship to the way that women artists can use their own body. I would never use another body in my photographs. It has to be me. So I'm the author of the work. And I also made a series of photographs for the exhibition which explore this the relationship between abstraction, representation, and a kind of city space. So I'm going to run through these quickly, as I'm aware that I'm... Did we start 10 minutes late? No. Okay. Okay. I'm hoping for another 10 minutes. So these are what you're looking at here are collages. So they're I was one of the Dada artists, and for me he is a Dada artist that I've been always very compelled by is Max Ernst, particularly his series of etching collages called La Semaine de Bonté, where he unites, going back again to this, the way in which the media can unite disparate things, that that if you photograph the whole thing, everything can kind of glue back together as if it was an entirely convincing sort of tableau. So I made a series of collages using the Duchamp's rotor reliefs and images of Sophie Talbot Arp's Bar or Bet, which is part of a, it was a collaboration between Theo van Doesburg, Sophie Talbot Arp and Hans Arp, and they reconfigured an old military building in Strasbourg and made this fantastic kind of modernist sort of palace where there's a bar, there's a cinema dance hall, there's a salle de fête, and it's just stunning, and it's just this glorious sort of modernist, abstract, geometric confection. So I, and one of the Bar au Bête is reconstructed in the house constructive in Zurich, so it was very important for me to refer to that legacy. So again, the positive, negative, with this kind of this layover of the of Duchamp's rotor reliefs, which are these kind of pulsating, erotic, spinning discs, which you've all seen. So it's, I'm kind of doing a cut-up, I guess. Oh, this is the sculpture, the Marcel Duchamp, portrait of Marcel Duchamp by Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven. Okay. So one of, I found a lot of archival images of the, of Bar au Bête, and I photographed my own hand holding this weird thing that I found. And again, it was one of these serendipitous things. And it was a, it's a grinding stone that's used for grinding machinery. So there's a kind of, what you do is you sort of use it to smooth out these kind of circular metallic shapes. And it's designed to be held in the hand. It's lovely to feel. But it's also weirdly, it's very phallic because it's got a groove along the top, like the top of a penis. And then it's like an egg. So it's like this weird, it's a very surrealist object, I guess. So I've made a series of photographs where I would photograph my hand, photocopy it again, so it started to attain the kind of graininess of the original archival photograph. And then I would find ways to splint them together. This is my, the title of this work is called Increasingly You Will Love Glass, and it's my version of Duchamp's large glass, and it, it's a number of things. It's part of the Bar au Bête. It's also a series of interposed images of my own hands holding this kind of grindstone fetish thing. And then there's, as well as a rotor relief, there's also an image that I have always loved, because when I was a kid, my going back to what Barbara was saying about counterculture parents, my mum and dad had a collection of Oz and IT magazines, International Times, which were these kind of wonderful, countercultural, often quite pornographic, often quite misogynistic, sort of magazines about politics, race, culture, society, Marxism. And there was in the one of the magazines that I found, I used to furtively crawl under the bed when they went out shopping. So this was the beginning of my secret fascination with images. There was an image of Germaine Greer that she had self-authored, where she had photographed herself facing the camera with her her vagina and her ass fully revealed, and then it was cut into a series of circles, a la Duchamp rotor relief, and then spun. So you could see it was her, but she had become disarticulated. And I thought this was a kind of wonderful way to present oneself nude, but without being configured as something like a nude. And do you want to have a look at it? Shall I just... Yeah. It's... if you haven't seen it, it's kind of... where do we go? There you go. Yeah. And when I saw it, I thought this is like a rotor relief, and then, but it's obviously, yeah, it's 1973, so I guess not. Right. So there is a sense in which these things, you know, kind of, there's a haunting of images, and there's also a sense in which, as with the book that I hope I'll have chance to quickly run through, that when I'm making the images, I'm aware of a kind of a certain theoretical framework for the way that I'm looking at things. But there comes a point where you just immerse, and the gluing together of images and shapes and forms happens at a very unconscious level, I would say. And it's not something, I used to try and police it quite rigidly, and then particularly for this project and for the book itself, I really stopped doing that because it, you know, if I tried to theorize or rationalize it in advance, I just couldn't do it. It had to be something where I kind of went under, which I think maybe, you know, we all understand in a way. It's like if you think about breathing, you can't do it, but then you have to think about it later on. But it, this was another piece that was in the exhibition. So it's my arm, and I'm kind of playing with these kind of spinning discs. And again, it's three or four layers of acetate and collage, and yeah. This was the most explicit work or reference, if you like, that I made to the Dada tradition that I was in. So again, it's a homage to Sophie Thaba Arp and her strange sculpture. So and if you can see, I'll try not to tread on this mat, but just here there's a little bit of red, which is where I couldn't get enough grey makeup inside my ear. So. And again, that was an accidental thing, but it was really important that it happened that way. And what I'm holding is, in front of my face, I'm just holding a cutout of the Sophie Thaba Arp mask. So again, the photographic register just unites the whole thing. And it's really important that my mouth meets the kind of mouth of the... So there's also a thing which I hope I can get onto really quickly about the idea of the atavistic fantasy of the primitive that fueled early modernism. And so this is a kind of Sophie Thaba Arp. This is the upstairs in the museum House Constructive, Sophie Thaba Arp collage, the one that I'm standing on. And then there's a Hopi influenced costume made by Thaba Arp that she used in her many performances. And there's a strong sense in which a lot of the kind of geometric forms and the kind of inventiveness of early modernism, I'm talking about Art Deco, I'm talking about Surrealism, I'm talking about Cubism, and certainly I'm talking about Dada and Constructivism, where this idea of the primitive, the African mask, the oceanic sculpture, North African ceramics, the decorative elements of so-called non-Western art or non-European art, it fires the imagination of the of early modernism, and this I think is modernism's unconscious. It's kind of in a way modernism is formed by the very counter narratives that it tries to repress. So the very thing that it's trying to distance itself from, you know, from anything kind of backward and non-industrial, seems to be the thing that kind of emerges. So I'm interested in that in terms of how that relates to ideas of the female, and obviously in my performances a la Josephine Baker, I'm bringing up this kind of uncomfortable truth about the way in which early modernism kind of feasted on a fantasy of otherness, of the exotic. This is an ink drawing poem by Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven, and it says, "Wheels are growing on rose bushes, grey and affectionate." So she produced many of these. This is her. This is and she is the originator. This is one of her artworks, and it's called Enduring Ornament, and it was the first found object sculpture. So it predates the fountain by about 4 years. It was made in 1913, and she picked it up on the way to her marriage to the Baron Freytag von Loringhoven, and used it as a wedding ring. So it's a bit of pipe, basically. She also made a sculpture called God, which was what they called a plumber's trap, which is the pipes underneath a sink. And now everybody is saying that she was the author of the pissoir, the fountain. She was Armut. And because Armut is obviously a German name, and if you say it quickly, Armut, it means poverty. And this woman lived poverty. I don't have time to really go into it, but she was pretty, you know, she lived pretty roughly. This is one of the smaller sculptures in the exhibition that's at the museum, and it's another found object. It's an earring. And when I saw it, it took my breath away because it's tiny, like a little fossil, and it's rusty, and it's, again, it's one of the early objets trouvés, and it's under a bell jar, like a kind of little fragile fossil moth butterfly. And when they unwrapped it, I kind of fell apart. This is is Elsa's body in a Man Ray sculpture, Man Ray photograph. So again, you know, the anonymous woman, the body, I don't need to kind of harp on this too much. Hannah Hawke, and that's the rosebush, and that's Sheila Legge. So, I know I'm really running out of time, but this is the front page of my book. This is the book, and it's indented. So I've watched people pick it up, and they all run their fingers over it like that. And it's a fleshy thing. I won't tell you what part of the body it is, but it looks as if it's coming out of an eye. And the eye itself is what looks like a kind of retina is a part of Duchamp's rotor relief. So I'm going to flash through the book at lightning speed, and then leave you in peace. So here we go. So again, the title of the talk: Your Eyes Are My Hands. And I wrote something that I wanted to say about that. I scribbled it down. In relation to the whole talk here, it's about the intimate relationship between looking and making. For me, it's the same thing. And I also wanted it to be an erotic provocation to the viewer, because I didn't want to make a book that people just picked up and went, oh yeah, artist book, yeah, great. It would be something that held people's attention. And it was done in chapter form. That's the first chapter. And the text was another kind of collage cut-up of poems and manifestos by Mina Loy, Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven, Gertrude Stein, who I see as a Dada writer, Emmy Hennings, and Juliette Roche. And it was a kind of a collaging of something that was already fragmented and broken up. And what I was trying to do was glue this stuff back together again. And this was my unconscious at work. I wanted to make these fragments. I didn't want to just reprint little bits of poem. I wanted to glue them together so that they made an immersive narrative, so that there was a sense of a story being told. I need to do this here because I can't do it any other way. So, yeah. So some of the work is in the show. Yeah. Quick. Yeah. And there's an architectonic element to the text. Hands passing nothing. Some of the text is very provocative, and some, I don't know if you can read it, but okay. I'll read out some of the more provocative ones. This one was I'm going to read this out because it's a mashup of, if you like, of not a mashup, a kind of gluing together of a poem by Gertrude Stein and Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven, and it reads: nudge it, kick it, prod it, push it. What is the wind? What is it? Where is the serene length? It is there, and a dark place is not a dark place. Only a red and a white and a black. Only a yellow and a green, a blue. A pink is scarlet. A bow is every colour. A line distinguishes it. A line just distinguishes it. And the way I selected the poems was anything that was to do with geometry, machinery, or desire was in. And I cut everything up and, again, pushed it together. We're nearly at the end. And it ends with, what else is love but electricity? That's it.
I've only got 15 minutes, haven't I?
Sorry about that.
15 minutes over, my dear.
I know.
Not fair.
I'm very bad at that.
I know, but it's not fair because everybody has trains and buses. wonderful. Let's just get... Oops, thank you. Oops. Okay, I'm going to be trapped in various ways. Thank you very much for the invitation and the prompt. I was saying to some people that if anybody asks me to do anything now, I think, can I talk about Marilyn Monroe? And if I can, I do it. So this is another occasion. Okay, the title is The Missing Witnessness, Monroe Fascinance and the Unguarded Intimacy of Being Dead. And one more. Okay, well, I suffered a very bad shock. I was reading Anthony Summers' book, Goddess, The Secret Lives of Marilyn Monroe, first published in 1985, and I turned the page of the final signature of illustrations and came face to face with this image. I've never seen it before, this photograph. Now, you have to appreciate that Summers' book appeared before the internet, before the free flow of found, uploaded, recycled access to any and every image that can be digitalized. During his research in the 1980s, Summers had come across, this analog photograph in the LA police files. The image is not, however, a police photograph. The body had been unclaimed and had been stored for some time in a cupboard either before or after this moment. One account of its production, that of the photograph, suggests that the photograph had been illegally taken by a press photographer, thus without authorization and in contravention of the protocols in which the unguarded corpse should not be left unprotected from such intrusion. In effect, the image has been stolen from its subject. But what subject is that? Now, an important feature of the materiality of the photograph is that there is an inscription on it, the case number 62509462, and another set of digits, 8562JB, i.e., JB's autopsy on the 5th of August 1962. Another image, also with that date identification, has also recently surfaced in the world of the internet. It shows the body at a different angle on its side. I think you need to move because you're going to be so uncomfortable. There's other seats over there. I mean, honestly. Okay. There's an awful lot of the images. Okay. It shows the body at a different angle and on its side. We see the face head on from above. These are therefore probably autopsy photographs, official, but they still have no name. So what are we seeing? And is that the same question as asking whom are we seeing? Can this be the same woman as a named image, its apparent former subject, or is she still the subject of the image? Or what about this one? Wherein lies the difference between these images? Is it in the referent, is it in the signified, or the relation of photography to death? Now, why did Summers publish this photograph? It appeared in the context of a book proposing a conspiratorial theory about the murder of Marilyn Monroe. Therefore, the photo serves, within that context, as legal or forensic evidence. It functions as the index of a crime. It is not so much a representation of a dead woman as indeed of a murdered victim, whose solitary pathos here is directed at the reader's emotions. Now, the association with autopsy opens the body to the enigma of a death that no one can fully explain, including the forensic coroner or medical examiner. This death, as we know, has no finality because neither medical science nor historical research can determine what it means. All the photographs that exist to record an event on the night of the 4th to the 5th of August 1962 provide no solution to its mystery because several of them seem to have been staged. And nor is this itself. So currently, this once found controversially published image can be purchased for reproduction. The license to a high-definition reproduction would cost me $485 from Getty Images, who control all the crime scene images now. It can also be found on this wonderfully named website, Find a Death. As such, it indicates a current need or appetite for those who want to confront it. Now, Summer's reproduction of a low-quality anonymous re-photograph answers to the image status of its apparent subject, because by 1985, Munro had been extensively remade by an exponential proliferation of her photographic iconicity by contrast to her actual movies. The shift from persona in movie star publicity to spectacular iconization had, of course, begun within a month of Marilyn Monroe's death on the 4th of August 1962, but as we shall see, its primary locus was art. But this shift can be traced firstly by looking at the shocked reports of her death and its use of photographs on the 6th of August 1962. So the announcements of Monroe's passing appears in newspapers on Monday, 6th of August. The recurring format matches bold out headline to news image, not a still or posed photograph. This is an exception without an image that just prints words, very fascinating, but not for now. The press had had to scramble for and then replayed only recent images, publicity stills from the actor's current film production. How odd to combine the harsh news headlines with images of a lively smiling woman or a waving woman, or a publicity still, although there are some that seem to try and suggest a certain amount of anxiety by choosing an image from a movie. But look at those headlines. Marilyn dead. Marilyn found dead. Marilyn kills herself. Accident or suicide. Marilyn Monroe dies. Pills blamed. Marilyn improbable suicide. Marilyn Monroe, it looks like suicide. I just want to end this small survey with a later news story from British press illustrating the last living image taken by George Barris. And this sequence tells us what images were available in early August 1962 from 20th Century Fox. Now, one or two were of older vintage as they'd been published in magazines during the 1950s. It would take a collector to have a named photographer's formal still from earlier in the 1950s, and of course Andy Warhol was one such collector of the photograph from 20th Century Fox photographer Frank Powolny, 1901 to 1986, here shown in a photo shoot with him. He was the 20th Century Fox official photographer and produced some extraordinary images of her. Now, within a few weeks of her death, it was Andy Warhol who created the first Memento Mori, a work of mourning for another white working-class kid ground up in the system. He called it Golden Marilyn, dated August 1962. His is the first response and to and with an image. His work also isolates the head and face. And he's made a huge painting with a tiny, cropped, silkscreen image of the photograph face with carefully positioned half-opened lips and lowered eyelids planted in a field of Byzantine gold. He knew about icons. Choosing this one photograph from the formal photo shoot done at the time that Monroe was making the film Niagara in 1952, Warhol was being an historian. That film, released in January 1953, initiated the annus mirabilis that made the small-time player who'd been hanging unsuccessfully around the Hollywood studios, getting nowhere since 1948, into a star. The image is, however, the least true to the type within which the studio bosses would subsequently imprison Monroe. Here she was asked to project the persona of a calculating, murderous femme fatale that Munro played in the unlikely film instead of the vanilla ice cream, comedic, bouncing sexuality later imposed upon her. Now, the face that we see certainly has some key elements by which this actor is recognizable. But these features, the lowered eyelids, the pouting red mouth, were only produced in 1953 when she was in her Jean Harlow phase, miming the golden days of 1930s Hollywood glamour. Warhol clearly monumentalized it and also remembered it for its similar but golden moment of retro glamour. Now, in 1973, 11 years after that death, novelist Norman Mailer produced his infamous biography. It had begun as an essay to accompany a publication of photographs taken by 24 named and renowned photographers for whom Munro had posed for still photographs. These formed an exhibition called Marilyn Monroe, The Legend and the Truth. We could, for the first time in 73, now buy in one paper-based publication a collection of the great photographic sittings in which Munro had partnered photographers in producing works in their oeuvre and works that would progressively install her in cultural memory through still photography. And with the Mailer book, we encounter once again a face-on glamour image, an enlarged close-up, a headshot from 1962, on its cover, repeating the Warhol style. Now, if we now move to 1985, where I began, and to the page in the biography of Summers, having been exposed to a quick survey of what one might have seen up to this publication, the shock of seeing such an image can be better imagined. The photograph is posthumous. Marilyn Monroe is dead by this point. But Summers gives it a title, Marilyn in Death. Marilyn dead is one thing, as you saw in the newspapers, but what is it to be in death? Is that not a somewhat strange formulation? What has happened for such a phrasing to be possible? What we're seeing is in the photograph is a head, or perhaps you might say it's a face with suggestions of the shrouded body that's cut out. Is this then a new kind of close-up, another kind of Roland Barthesian face object? Are we seeing the face of a person or looking into the face of a corpse? Do corpses have faces? And do we make a distinction for profound reasons between the living and the dead body, the corpse from the corps, as it were in French, and some distinction from the person in death? What face might death have? In a deeply embedded ritual, people traditionally cover the faces of the dead. Often it is said for fear that they might look back at us from the other domain. We close their eyes. Death therefore becomes sleep so as not to frighten us with eyes no longer seeing, but seemingly staring from elsewhere. Bodies are often prepared after death for viewing before burial by elaborate cosmetic and other procedures to present the living appearance of sleep to those accustomed to viewing open coffins before burial or cremation. Here is Elvis, and here is something kind of curious, which is on the internet, which is actually a sculptural attempt to imagine what Munro looked like after Whitey Snyder had reconstructed her. But this photograph was taken after an autopsy and placed in a book. Radical investigations and transformations of an individual's body that open up the chest to remove organs, cut into and lift the face, drill into the skull and remove the brain, are only undertaken forensically when the cause of death is unknown. A post-mortem does not awake all of us. It's not a normal process for those who die. It links being dead to enigma and the silent witness of the medical examiner or the secret study of the pathologist. This is not, therefore, a photograph of Marilyn Monroe. I could say it's an image of Norma Jean Mortensen, later known as Norma Jean Baker, also known as Marilyn Monroe, at the point of the maximum vulnerability of a human being, transgressed firstly by the forensic pathologist, and secondly, possibly by the hunger of the press photographer for a last image, or by Summers for printing it. So what is produced in that transaction of unguarded intimacy in relation to death and the image? That is my question. In Summers' book, The last image titled Marilyn in Death is accompanied by a text by the author where he acknowledges that something drastic has happened. He writes, "The publication of this photograph, which the author located in police files, has proved controversial. It should be emphasized that the picture was taken after autopsy, and it is the pathologist's work that has caused the face to sag. Before the procedure, say those present, the lifeless Marilyn remained beautiful." So the controversy apparently lay not alone in the publication of an image of a post-autopsy corpse, left alone and unguarded, but in the fact that what it showed was the drastic effect of what cutting the muscles to remove the face and examine and remove the brain has done to an appearance. A face once beautiful now sags, which means it's no longer beautiful. The image has in effect been defaced, the icon exposed to materiality and corporality. Now, Summers does not mention here the other peculiarities well known to those of us who read or listened to crime stories featuring the wayward barrister Rumpole. What we are seeing is signs of lividity. Lividity is the apparent bruising on those parts of the body which are an effect of the blood pooling after death at the lowest point. Now, Marilyn Monroe apparently was found face down, and if this is actually a photographer in the bed, she had her face facing the other way. The circulating photograph of the body of the actor in her bed often actually shows a reconstruction staged to include the strange telephone that was part and parcel of the cover-up. Now, one thing that we know is that we are most vulnerable in death. The dignified protection of the dead is indeed one of the first signs of a specifically human culture. It involves, however, imagining an identity that does not cease with the last beat of organic life. It involves defeating the palpable truth that a dead person is like any other dead, once living thing. But for the consciousness of the living to survive this encounter with the finality of not being alive, death is created as a state beyond an event, as a means of inventing the idea of the human. Death thus defines us as a concept and is enacted by rituals surrounding the handling of those who can no longer handle anything themselves. It is therefore the final ontological crime to transgress our codes for the dignity of the dead. Now, according to Hegel, Christian thought and theology, and hence its iconography, which has dominated the Western European imagination for almost two millennia, circles around the paradox of the natural death, the death of the body, and its overcoming through one death, a sacrifice made out of such divine love that death itself is overcome once and for all. Now, the Christian narrative moves swiftly through a formally imagined redempted sequence of suffering and death, entombment and resurrection. The body that is the subject of and subjected to this passage through death back to life is more often than not represented as the figure of pure heroic pathos, in which suffering becomes the transient physical ordeal that will lead to resurrected and eternal beauty as a result of the divinely appointed victory over human mortality. Meeting Rosalind Krauss's most exigent criteria for formal analysis, Michelangelo's drawings of the crucifixion, entombment, and resurrection would be the apotheosis of this tendency on the basis of vertical, horizontal, vertical. I'm afraid we're going to have to tarry a little bit more in this era of the late 16th century to go through the dark night of Protestantism. Here is the shocking brutality of a Protestant imaginary, a singled in Hans Holbein the Younger's stark predella, The Body of the Dead Christ and the Tomb, 1521-22. Holbein was said to have used an actual body fished out of a river as a model for his corpse, catching the open eyes, the gaping mouth, and the rigor of the hands. Holbein had been taken as a young artist to Eisenheim to see Matthias Grunewald's crucifixion and his predella, which is the underneath, which complete with its gaping body. I just want to contrast this with another image of the dead Christ in a lovely shroud from the 18th century. Now, in her study of Melancholia, Black Sun, Julia Kristeva devotes a chapter to Holbein's dismal painting, exploring his aberrant figuration of the dark and unattended, unwitnessed moment. She places the work in its cultural historical moment of early 16th century European humanism and iconoclasm that marked the emergence of Protestantism, and the novel theology of which Hans Holbein the Younger is, for her, the subject. In this novel Protestant insistence on the reality of suffering, this painting, according to Kristeva, offers us an unadorned representation of death, which conveys to the viewer an unbearable anguish before the death of God, here blended with our own, since there is no hint of transcendence. A God's, hence now our own, dereliction is seen at its most intractably material. To do that, the eyes are open, the mouth gapes, the hands cramp, the skin turns green or yellows. For Kristeva, in confrontation, Holbein's confrontation of the entombed body, in it, humanization has reached its highest point. And she adds, Holbein's chromatic and compositional asceticism renders such a competition between form and a death that is neither dodged nor embellished, but set forth in its minimal visibility, in its extreme manifestations constituted by pain and melancholia. Now, if this is man knowing death, woman in Christianity passes through it by sleeping. In the Orthodox Christian tradition, the Virgin Mary merely falls asleep and is translated into heaven in that state. It's known as dormition in Latin, or koimesis theotokou in Greek, and falling asleep, koimesis, is the word from which we get koimeterion, cemetery, which is a place of sleeping. But under the pressure of the militant Catholic Counter-Reformation, and we will get back to Monroe shortly, Caravaggio daringly introduced a disturbing degree of desacralization of the sleeping translation, the Virgin, in a highly controversial painting of the death of the Virgin Mary. The painter represents a dead woman. Perhaps under Caravaggio's inspiration, but from a very different motivations of her own witnessing the death of her mother at the age of 12, the painter Artemisia Gentileschi confronted us with death in two works, using the legendary narrative of Cleopatra. This work is very remarkable for the fact the woman is not yet quite dead, thus leaving her still to be a subject of her own process of dying, whereas this later work is unrelieved in its presentation of the pallor and the disfigurement of the face. Compare that to the Caravaggio. Now, other artists of the modernist turn towards finding death in the everyday arrested at the passage towards death, for instance, dying in Monet's fading image of his beloved Camille, where rapid and obsessive brushwork seeks to capture and stay the moment that he came across the awareness of dying. Or we have the famous Hodler studies of his lover dying agonizingly from cancer, studied so brilliantly by Elizabeth Bronfen, hardly repeated again until Hannah Wilke's Dairy self-documentation of her decline from cancer in 1994. Now, the death of even cultural deities do not promise us relief, for there is a point at which death, ending, dying, being no more, ceasing to be, expiring, being deceased, defunct, bereft of light, being dead, for those who know John Cleese, has come to be confronted. Even if iconicity resurrects an image, itself already as a photograph, carrying conceptually mortality into its very existence. As Barthes insisted, the photograph carries death from its inception, as the image outlives the sitter, captured in a moment of being, conferring on the sitter, even in life, the immanence of death. The image is therefore a perpetual death mask. These form another sign of contact with death. The Lawrence Hutton collection at Princeton presents faces in the neutral pallor of plaster faces that appear to be sleeping. Rigor mortis has passed, and it seems, or the mask was taken before it began. There is no rictus here of gasping life or loosening muscles. Can we tell the difference from these masks, from this, from Michael Jackson, taken from life when he was making Thriller, or of the dead woman, L'Inconnue de la Seine, so beautiful and suffering that the autopsy technician decided to make a death mask? And what happens if we record actual age in the face of this extraordinary juxtaposition of the poet H.D.? Now, I wonder if the horror of the severed head Medusa has been lurking in the background of this talk. It takes a new turn in our times, when we have a feminist reading of its meaning. According to Arendtian philosopher Adriana Cavarero, who's coined the concept horrorism for the new forms of violence that destroy the bodies of the unarmed in suicide bombs and other violence, but often leave the heads lying free, untouched. And she says, what causes the most profound horror is disfigurement, since figura, like the French word figure, means face, but face is the site of singularity. Face also represents our own constitutive vulnerability as a human before another. And Cavarero therefore defines horrorism, that which explodes the body and defaces it, as an ontological crime. She invokes the trope of Medusa not only in relation to the severed head of a dismembered body, but because the injured face functions as the locus of subjective singularity. Medusa, she writes, reminds us that the killing of uniqueness, as Hannah Arendt would say, is an ontological crime that goes well beyond the inflicting of death. Medusa confirms that the crime is visited on a body, not just vulnerable, but reduced to a primary situation of absolute helplessness. Now, I have drawn upon Cavarero for my own recent reflections on the tragic story of two young women killed in a suicide bombing whose severed heads were confused for each other's, since the nature of such violence frequently severs and preserves the head. So I've made my journey through my own builder atlas of the pathos formulae, the formulations of suffering for death and sleep, and I want to take you back to my primary image. Now, I've met this image before, actually, not since 1985, but in another place, clothed in the feminist affect in the paintings of the British artist Margaret Harrison, created in 1994. Her book, Moving Pictures, in which I encountered them, also uses a frontal image from the 1962 as its source, although her painting washes it with a terrible sadness. Now, Margaret Harrison has added color. You see there's a kind of thematic coming through the day, boldly as she sets the face against an intensely red ground that silhouettes the profile. She enlivens the earth colors of the face with traces of red and blue. The core elements of the photograph are there, the dark eyebrows, the ear, the cosmetically shortened nose, and now a thin line of the closed and drooping mouth. The head rests on what those of us who watch Silent Witness or Lewis know is the special device for supporting the head on an autopsy table. Another Harrison painting plays the maid image against an orange ground, tinting the covering sheet with watery blue. The washed peroxided hair is hued with purple in its shadows and Naples yellow in its highlights. The livid face is blued and sprinkled with pointillous red touches. But this painting declares its source, writing onto the shroud the title given by Summers, Marilyn in Death. I'm better prepared to match the words to the painting precisely because it is a painting, a translation of an image in a book. Perhaps it was a protest against the publication. It's a work that produces a new intimacy in bringing this image into being by strokes of watery color on a ground. Each feature has had to be created by movements of the hand, dabs of the brush, imaginings of the vital colors of a once living form. Once the basic image had emerged on the page, the artist remains with it, slowly, gently adding its patches, marks, and washes. Each touch is a touch at the threshold the painting is created between the artist and the image that carries an evocation of Munro into this new space. Artworking is not reproduction, but transformation for the viewer, and it now enters into the field of making. The bruise must emerge from the page as color, just as the blood it represents once settled under the skin. You will note also that the image has been carefully repositioned on the page. If we compare the photograph and the painting, we can see that the artist has distanced herself a little or approached closer. She's played with the spacing, as we can see in the juxtaposition of four less intensely colored essays in graphite on paper. Closing in or withdrawing, these produce very different effects and generate diverse affects as the series delivers Harrison's prolonged reverie before this fragment, which she is remaking with her strokes. The bold colored versions contrast with those in subtle overall tonalities. Scale matters, as the viewer is presented with something now monumental, so that intimacy is not unguarded. I would suggest, however, that in this transformation, the face is no longer one that has lost its contours. It is no longer sagging through severed muscles so that it no longer offers its beautiful appearance. It is as if the artist has recast the brutal scene of her photographic encounter in Summer's book to transfigure the corpse into a sleeping woman to whom she wishes to get close to shield the unguarded photograph with her compassionate touch. The nature of the transformation through the delicacy of watercolor tips the affective scale towards a kind of tenderness that relieves that unguarded exposure of the individual original in its snatched production and controversial reproduction to produce an intimacy guarded now by the artist's inventiveness in recreation of an image as a painting. The staying with the image comes closer to what Bracha Ettinger's long reflection on the possibilities of a non-phallic gaze in and through painting has named fascinance. Fascinance is the process that performs and induces an aesthetic gesture of compassion. She writes, "Fascinance is an aesthetic event that operates in the prolongation and delaying of the time of the encounter event, and allows a working through of matrixial differentiation in jointness and co-poiesis. Fascinance can only take place in a border linking with a real, traumatic, or phantasmatic, compassionate hospitality. But fascinance might turn into fascinum, the dreadful killing and arrest, when castration, separation, weaning, or splitting abruptly intervene." So now we come at last to my last shock before this image. And I had this shock in the Tate Gallery in Modern during my dutiful visit to see the exhibition Marlene Dumas, The Burden of the Image, in 2014. And I came across this painting dated to 2008. Now let it be said straight off, I don't think I like Marlene Dumas' work. I think I'm actually hurt by it. I find its psychic economy too fierce, harsh, wounding. Its evident register of trauma offers me no transport station of trauma, no transformation, or rarely. Dumas' work is undoubtedly bold and intense. But my hunch is that it's hiding the sources of its intensity behind the screen of the found image from which so many of her works are painted. The found image, usually from the media, is itself a trace from and index of the world, at second hand, removed. The image from elsewhere thus serves her as a distanciating mechanism. It's turned into an icon, hypostasizing frequently the suffering of others. Yet the nakedness of the other as captured in the photograph is in her work heightened by translation. The images Dumas collects and reuses are themselves wounded by her creative retranslation into and by means of the very powerful nature of her painted gestures. These gestures of painting register the artist's bodily work on the image and the canvas. They disperse her psychic energy across the surface, which is then curiously given a face by the intimacy between her painting, its reference source in an image, and its paradoxical defacement. Choosing a word such as defacement knowingly suggests an implicit ethical transgression. Face is, of course, one of the key conceptual terms of Levinas's ethics that he found paradoxically when reading a novel which described people in a line studying the nape of the neck of the person before them as they stood in line going into a prison. Thus, face is not the image of a face. For Levinas, it is expression or appeal. It is the nakedness of the other, destitution and misery beneath an adopted countenance. One might then say that face is a kind of living pathos formula that emerges at the sight of an encounter in which both parties are exposed to another in an unguarded but unknown intimacy, articulated by the pathos of the body, whose register is primarily neither conscious recognition nor unconscious investment. It is a formally created space between affect and responsibility. Just a few more minutes. Now I want to share with you the letter I wrote to Marlene Dumas, which I have not yet sent. "Dear Marlene Dumas, your work has been on the edges of my consciousness for some time. As a feminist art historian, your work has often been suggested to me as a field I should explore. I know very well one of the champions of your paintings, Ernst von Alphen. You and I share, after all, a South African birthplace, although my passing immigrant family barely gives me the right to claim any real relation to the country of your much longer settled Afrikaner ancestors. I'm writing now because I was more than distressed when in the final section of the Tate Show, I encountered one small painting. Oh, not you! Not Marlene Duma! Why? I cried out to myself. Everybody looked around and wondered why I was behaving so badly. Now, your title is Dead Marilyn. I can see, however, that it's a rather wonderful painting, qua painting. Your usually subdued palette of greys and browns and whites. Is this a South African refusal and acknowledgement of the political power of colour in your life? Have been lifted with touches of lilac and turquoise greens. The photograph from which it is painted is a blurry, grainy black and white. So adding colour becomes a potential gesture of enlivening. Yet lilac and green are colours associated with bruising and decay. They take me back to Holbein's Dead Christ. I know you know the work because you play with these horizontal bodies in narrow frames. Lots of times. Now, your tones are not the warm tones of living skin. Their hue emphasizes the fact that we are looking at a corpse. Your bold strokes of paint translate the straight washed hair of the blonde hair of the original. Uncrimped, curled or styled, its flow is the in this hair of this person we have never seen thus. The energy and movement of your brush strokes give it force and weight. They also insist on the movement of the loaded brush, its own hairs parting to deliver tints and tones of pinks and blues. The features in the photograph that appear black are dark greens and shadows are paler. Your paintbrush has moved with care to shape the ear. Her face is no longer livid. You have worked the mouth, but not quite scaled the nose, I think. The heavy stroke that is made to represent the closed eyelids stand proud. How many strokes did it take to make this? I can see you followed the farther contour of the face afterwards, almost making it a profile. The numbers become smudges. They remain to index the source. It must matter. You've also moved in, much, much closer to the head, so the hair almost touches the top of your canvas. Now, I did some more research and discovered that you made the work for an exhibition called Measuring My Own Grave at LA Mocha and MoMA in 2008. You stated that you made this painting for the American show specifically, where you wanted to make big paintings for America because the Americans make big paintings. But you say you actually made it quite small. One might even say it's intimate, 40 by 50 centimeters. And then you add your own account. Making a very small painting relates to my own history. My mother died in 2005. I did not know how to give that experience a form. Things come to you when you're ready for them. You tell me that an old newspaper image fell out of one... Sorry, that shouldn't have gone forward. An old newspaper fell out of your boxes. And you also relate the coming of this image and the painting of it to the larger sphere of death, the war in Iraq at the time. Her death becomes a historical monument. Dead Marilyn expresses the end of an era. But I see you paint death a lot, maybe for that, mostly for that exhibition. You seem to be very drawn to heads of dead people that you find in photographs, sometimes in other people's paintings. But you make these giant severed heads. You lose me in your painting. Now, I could have been a bit mollified about the Munro painting when you linked it to your own bereavement and to the discovery of the photograph. But the question I want to put to you, and what to myself, is the photograph of a dead woman named Marilyn Monroe, after her autopsy, available for anyone to project onto it whatever they wish? Can it become a screen for their own situations or projected effects or experiments in painting or defected grief? Does its existence and situation claim anything from anyone who sees it because of the nature of the photograph and the situation of vulnerability to a gaze when unpredicted in death that it represents? Is there an ethics that denounces the politics of a practice that speaks its own veiled disclosures behind the publicly circulating, the found image, when the circulation of a photographic image of a dead individual has already breached deep cultural codes governing the most unguarded vulnerability and the most intimate singularity of death of the subject, their death? Yours in feminist friendship, Griselda Pollock. So I'm finally going to conclude, just 2 seconds. I want to conclude this provisional exploration and meditation on this one photograph by playing us through the images that form one body of work created by Norma Jean Baker, working in 1946 with the Hungarian photographer André de Dies. She had just become a blonde. She was an untried model on an early photo shoot, and she gave to the lens of Di Dinesh her face unmade up, washed, gleaming. Wrapped in a black shroud and for his camera on a windswept beach, she performed a strange narrative across a series of frames. The sequence ends with this Bartesian close-up. Are we now once again lost in the face, exposed to light, to his viewfinder, to our gaze, in a fascinance that continues to elude our understanding of what it was in this duet of this woman and that camera that created something unclassifiable? This is not the making of Munro as an icon. The icon is she who became Munro through what she did in photography. The autopsy image may have indeed registered the same woman in death. It thus wounds us and shames us when it becomes undifferentiated from all the others in which she was the subject, the agent. For in death, no, rather in a deadly image, it is she who is the missing witness to the becoming of an image, even when that image mimics the sleep of death. When her image is stolen, when she no longer had life to shield her from unguarded intimacy, it becomes our fantasies and anxieties, our fear, our aggression, our envy, that overlay it with a mixture in the face of emotions, in the face of the impossible issue, which of course is our own death, that will never, ever have an image for us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. That's absolutely brilliant. We're going to move on straight to the Q&A because we're aware of time. So are there any...
Okay.
Sadie, do you want to...
Yeah.
Are there any questions for Sadie and Griselda? Yeah. Okay. Let's just... Wait...
The name of the woman. She was called Sheila Legge. Leg with a double G and an E.
I'll just leave it there for the vote.
Leg. Okay.
It's an English spelling, I think. Okay.
Oh, I was just going to ask Griselda whether she's going to send the letter.
Which what?
Are you going to send the letter to Marlene Dumas?
No, I might go and see her, but I don't know. No. Letters are a very useful method of situating the way that you write that allows you to not acquire the authority of saying something as an artist drawing. It's a means by which I can ask myself the questions. But she has every right as an artist to do what she likes. I mean, that's absolutely no question. It's my issue is to ask us all our complicity with the, it's a kind of the question that came up before about are there any ethics to this? And of course, because I worked so long on issues of Holocaust representation, I'm very interested in this. Should we or should we not expose images because we don't, we just treat them as images. We forget to treat them as images that have a relation to a subject who's no longer, precisely because they're dead, able to protect us. So it's not my... I'm not going to write about Marlene Dumas, even though as I wrote about this, I discovered that I had lots of things to say about her paintings that I didn't expect just by paying attention to them. But it's not at that level. because she's declared the reasons under why she did that, and I respect that. But I'm asking a much, much bigger question. Of all artists, are there any ethical obligations? It's just the same as you asked this morning of all psychoanalysts. Do you have the right to make your careers publishing the stories of those of us who tell you, you know, our deepest lives? And I think it's a huge issue in the psychological community at the moment. There's a question. Okay,
yes, this is a question this time that relates to what I was saying this morning. And thank you both for those wonderful and engrossing talks. And thank you especially, Griselda, for saying, although politely, what an awful painter Dumas actually is. It's about time it was said publicly in London. But there you are. For many reasons. No, one thing that is so interesting about this today is this relation between absolute singularities and the capacity to exchange anything between each other. And where is it that we can put together our different discourses and moments of seeing and hearing? So I just want to say something about the Holbein, because, and I'm sorry, it is a little about me, but when I finally went to see the Holbein, I went looking for what Chris Stavers said. I really went looking for that because I so much admire that essay. And I walked into the room in Basel, so that I got the tip of his nose first. And it literally took about 45 minutes to walk along it, with the guards in the room getting more and more anxious about what anyone was doing looking at a painting. And at the end, I had this unexpected reaction, because on the tip of his nose there's a point of light, and on the tip of his toe there's a point of light, and I experienced the resurrection. Chris Stavers vanished. I could admire that essay,
nice,
because I could no longer... I could no longer be with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that question of the singularity of vision and the singularity of hearing, which Denis and Diana were talking about, is something which we've only just begun to work through in terms of how we can speak to each other at all. So in that sense, I'm addressing myself to you for having opened that in the possibility of not a disagreement, but a non-coincidence in these singularities. Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit hesitant about saying this, but do you think, I find it quite shocking to see the photograph reproduced again and again here. And I wondered if we ask the question about which of us have the, you know, what do we think about ourselves when we use this material again and again? I was kind of wondering if you think about that as well. I'm not saying that, you know, obviously it's something to be looked at and talked about and written about. But there was a point where I thought, do I need to see this again? And it kind of started to feel like I was participating in an act of violence. I just wondered what you thought about that.
I think that's a great and important question. And it is one of the difficulties of deciding in which context it can be presented in such a way that the audiences are, you know, that it's framed. So, I mean, that's partly what I'm trying to say. It's framing the kind of the problem of it. And, of course, I commit the transgression, as you say, over and over again. But that's partly to, in my terms, what I was hoping to do was that by the repeat and that passing it through a whole different set of, you know, possible kind of, not contexts or genealogies or frameworks, that the image keeps getting different. Because what I was working towards was, in one sense, what would happen if it were translated? I mean, I'm sort of setting up, in a sense, what I think Harrison does compared with what Dumas does. So, in a way, but I was hoping that each time you met it, it was going to be seen differently. It was going to begin to stop just being this so-called image of Marilyn Monroe and begin to raise the question, which I think is a very deep one, which is why I had the two quotations at the front, between Freud saying, none of us can imagine our own deaths. Everyone else can die, but not ours. And then Lacan saying, and if you want to watch it, you should watch it on YouTube, the actual delivery of that, which is this violent things, you know. How would you survive if you did not, you know, how would you survive life if you didn't feel the certainty of death? And I wanted to play it between those two things, and by putting them on Zane at the beginning, do we dishonor images? So you're absolutely spot on, and it was a strategic decision, but the question of the structure of the paper was some kind of journey to the point at which it would, the weight of what is the difference between a feminist affective gesture and what I think, what I wanted to critique in the Marlene Dumas, which had shocked me so much, was what had happened to it. So I have no answer, but that I made that choice for that purpose and hoped that the circling back, it would keep getting different as I framed it.
Oh, hello. I just want to just pick up on that point about responsibility as an artist. Between 2003 and 2007, I made a series of works where I made a cadaver of myself, and I did a series of performative works with that cadaver. And those works were then put on the internet and in various websites to do with the galleries in which they were shown and so on. Then sort of fast forward to 2013, and my daughter was unfortunately in a situation of extreme bullying, and it turned out that one of the things that this very nasty child had used to bully my daughter was she'd taken the photos off the internet of my work and made a hate website dedicated to hating her, you know, this child, my daughter, and also obviously my artwork by coincidence, and absolutely shamed my daughter because the images had an element of nakedness to them. And so this whole area of responsibility, my response was to immediately ring the person whose website they were on and say, take that show off, remove that show, remove those images, you know, try and pull everything down, scale down, no naked images on my website of my work, even though I work in performance and do have some naked images. So this area around responsibility as an artist and the image is an absolutely huge one, and one that I've been very, very personally affected by. And it was very interesting the way that you raised this, Griselda, and I think it's a really, really valuable, particularly in this age of the mass dissemination of the image, as it sort of multiplies and goes forward to sort of really engage with.
Thank you. I have a question for you, but Lola first, and then I have a question for Sadie.
Well, just to pick up on that, is it not possible to think the other way, that in showing these images and recuperating them, you're opening us up to thinking about it and to, well, yes, that, to a kind of healing.
Well, that would be a nice lesson. I do think it actually, I want to make that link with what Sadie was doing, because I thought that was what was, in a sense, you didn't show us the donné, the étant donné. You didn't, as it were, re-inflict this thing, etc. And I thought that was really interesting, and that, of course, by the way in which you reworked it with the as it were, the mold, so it's the other way round, since there's the ones that therefore have the imprint of the body rather than, in a sense, of the cast.
Mm-hmm. But they're also the negative space. So linguistically, the woman is always the empty signifier as well, in Lacanian terms.
Yes, although, but the thing with making a cast and trace, I mean, I don't know, this Didi Ubermann's great long book about the trace and all the rest of it, et cetera, but it does mean that had to be in contact with the body. So there is a kind of, an indexicality as opposed to a representation. And then I thought this whole thing to do with what you were doing with, the grey paint, as it were, and then these moments of sort of liveliness. So all the way through your presentation, I was thinking there's a very interesting match with what I'm good, you know, I was trying to work out myself, you've already got them done much more brilliantly, that sort of sense of how, the question of the colours of life and the colours of death and the morbidity of black and white photography, in the same time, everything you were saying about the using the kind of question of the touch, but by the way in which you gave a body back to these negative phases, but then, again, it's this question of reinserting agency in some sense, as opposed to the étant donné, which completely deprives it. Even the fact I was trying to think, I better look it up, because there is a named person there.
It's Maria Martins, who's the wife of the Brazilian ambassador.
She's not a wife of the British. She's a sculptor.
A sculptor. I didn't get to that. She's a major sculptor.
Okay, you went... No, I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, that's right. Her husband also was an artist, to say
she
that.
She wasn't a very good sculptor. I don't like them.
Some people do. So she was exhibited in Document 13, wasn't she? Yeah. She turned up there, etc. But anyway... I'm not going to make judgments on that sort of school. But I thought that was kind of really important, that an example of a kind of process of reworking that doesn't dishonour. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not, and so, I mean, I think that there's actually quite an interesting conversation between the two presentations in terms of that.
There was also, I mean, as I was watching the beginning of your talk, I was thinking both our talks were about a type of, not necrophilia, but a kind of... looking at the way in which photographs are always about death at the end of the day. Even if the person is still alive, there's still it's a kind of marker in time, which means one day you're not going to be there. And black and white photographs for me are always spectral. They have this sort of, a sense of a ghost being reinterred, a disinterment of the corpse. And so my relationship with photography is quite, is overhung with the kind of with the feelings of and ideas about mortality and death, and I started working on this whole series of the black and white makeup and the reference to archival photographs at the time when my father was very ill. And I think retrospectively, this sense of time and the moments and photography and that kind of it marking the passage through our existence and it being the only relic left, the only trace, the only index, was very much kind of subconsciously going back to the kind of the ways in which we work with intimate material, was subconsciously driving the work. And it was a kind of, there was a trauma, I think, in some of this. And going back to what you said about Marlene Dumas, about the kind of, that her work is upsetting, I agree. I can hardly bear to look at it because of what the implication. But I feel that all art needs to, rather than to heal and to comfort and to reassure, it needs to throw you back on yourself. It needs to, not necessarily to provoke, but it needs to have, I'm quoting a friend of mine, it needs to have some poison. There needs to be a little bit like homeopathy, where there has to be a kind of inoculatory effect, that there's something in it that's uncomfortable, that's difficult, but it's gonna, this is a enabling thing. I think a lot of artists' work, certainly over the last 20 years, has been very much about an idea of social practice or a kind of, a reassuring, relationship to the viewer. And I can understand why that might seem to be important, particularly now, but not very well articulated, but I do think that there needs to be some grit in an artwork, something that pushes you back on yourself and forces a reconsideration of not just what you're looking at, but who you think you are and what you think the world is. So, But I was very interested in, particularly when we got to the point of colour and Margaret Harrison's work and then Dumas, and this thing about the colour coming, zoning in and out, and the sort of the animation and de-animation of the subject. And, but I don't know if I've gone off track a little bit.
Hi, I think you both did amazing talks. They were so enthralling. I just wanted to kind of touching on the idea of defacement and kind of the reappropriation and re-representation of an image or, especially specifically in this context, like a female's body that has been so...
A woman's
body that's been so kind of objectified and, re-represented. We're so kind of used to seeing that. And going back to what Sadie said about the inclusion of your own body within the work is always something that you have to treat very kind of carefully, so not to fall into these kind of, these practices of it kind of reinforcing kind of those negative, like, stereotypes and stuff. But do we think, I mean, can we not also kind of view that on the opposite side as kind of almost an empowerment, or by using your own body and kind of taking agency over that and kind of by using your own strength to put it out there, almost kind of neglecting the male gaze
in some way, although the camera can be viewed as male, is it, if it, but if it's self-activated and self-realized in your own work with a specific intention, you know, I know the male gaze will always be seen looking onto the woman, but I mean.
Okay, we're going to stop you there with you. Everybody has to take the word, the male gaze was made, was one mistake Laura Mulvey made to call it the male gaze. It's the masculinization. Right, it's a position. It's not an attribute of a biological sex or even a gendered sex. It's a positionality, right? And if you, so I absolutely outlaw the concept of the male gaze. It's a positionality, and I think you're absolutely right that, that there is. But there's a body of work, you know, like 40 years of artists negotiating that, and we're using these kind of. I mean, it's like, you know, we've. And it's not your fault, it's our fault, it's my generation's fault, because these terms came into play and they're now lumpen words like objectification and the male gaze. It's the question of strategic intervention. It's looking at each artwork or each piece of film or each thing. It's going to, how does it position you? How does it negotiate the kind of, the potential for falling into things or collapsing? And if we keep circulating those notions, we have something that it denies, going back to what also you were interested, right back to the Dadaists. They're already putting it into play, knowingly and unknowingly. And it, that's why I think it's crucial we understand, you know, the negotiation of this field of difficulties that needs very carefully to be read. It links back to the sessions this morning and what Adrian said. Well, it's the signifiers. It's how do those actually articulate the position from which you then see it. Right? And I think I would just encourage everybody, whenever you hear the male gaze, you know that it was just, it is in Laura Mulvey's original article and it should never have been there, because what she's arguing about is the masculinization. Just like we have a, you know, a whitening, we have, you know, a certain kind of heteronormativeness, there's a certain kind of gendering of the position from which you are put in relation to what you're looking at. And what I was trying to show, and I think it's very important that, you know, painting as a practice, other kinds of practices can displace that, can install other kinds of gazing. And it's, there's 30 or 40 years of artists and art theory, and what we've got is these, like, hammers, bang, you know, objectification, bang, you know, you think. So be gentle with it, and I think it will give you much more space, and I'm sure you have much to say on that as well. I'm sorry, rant over.
Thank you very much for your brilliant rant. What a wonderful way to end our day. Thank you so much. I would really, really like to thank all of our speakers today, our brilliant speakers. It's been an amazing day.
And the audience.
Yeah, so great question.
I was going to get to that. All of our speakers today and the support of the Freud Museum once again, because it's been really wonderful for us with our project Intimacy Unguarded to be able to have something hosted here. It's been fantastic, a fantastic setting for the day. Thank you everybody for coming.